All right, let's jump right in. We're doing a deep dive today into some Czech ride prep materials.
Excellent.
Looks like you sent me quite a few questions and answers. Must be getting ready for a Czech ride. One of the biggest milestones, right, for
Absolutely.
a pilot. So I'm thinking, beyond acing the Czech ride, what are some things that we can pull out of these questions and answers to make you a safer and more confident pilot?
That's a good point. I think the Czech ride is not about just ticking boxes. It's about building a foundation
Oh, yeah.
for a lifetime of safe
A
flying.
lifetime. Yeah,
Okay.
exactly. So let's start with pre-flight fundamentals.
Yeah.
You've got a stack of acronyms here, starting with Aviates.
Hmm.
I've always found this one helpful for making sure the plane is legally airworthy. But beyond just remembering what the letters stand for, how would you explain the importance of each element to, say, a nervous passenger who's never flown with you before?
That's a good question. I think the key is connecting those letters to real-world safety. So, for example, the A in Aviates stands for the annual inspection. It's not just paperwork. It's like taking your car in for a thorough checkup. Mechanics often find things during annuals that you might not notice, like tiny cracks in the engine mount, hidden corrosion.
Wow.
Catching these issues early can literally prevent accidents.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's easy to get caught up in the checklist mentality, but explaining it that way really brings home the why behind the regulation.
Exactly. And it builds trust
Yes.
with your passengers when they see you're taking safety seriously.
Speaking of building trust, there's also the Aero acronym for making sure you have all the required documents on board. It's like having your plane's passport and operating manual.
Right. That's a great analogy. Think about if you were crossing international borders, you wouldn't leave home without your passport.
No.
Same principle applies to flying. Your airworthiness certificate proves your plane is legally allowed to fly.
Right.
The registration shows who owns it. The operating handbook is like the instruction manual for safe operation.
Yeah, it's all there. Okay. So we've got the plane checked out, paperwork is in order, but then there's all the pre-flight planning. I see you've got NWKRFT highlighted in your notes, which I always remember as not without craft because I love a good snack on a long flight.
Yeah.
But seriously, walk me through why this acronym is especially important for pilots.
Well, I'd say it's about minimizing surprises and managing risk.
Okay.
Each element of NWKRT helps you anticipate potential issues before they become problems. For instance, checking NOTAMs alerts you to any temporary airspace restrictions or airport closures. Studying the weather forecasts helps you avoid thunderstorms or strong winds. And knowing the runway lengths at your destination and alternate airports ensures you can land safely. It's all about being prepared.
And that preparation probably goes a long way on check ride day too, showing the examiner you're thinking ahead. Speaking of check rides, I got to ask about this scenario you flagged about a friend offering to pay for a flight. The answer says no, and it all comes down to this common purpose rule. I've heard about this, but could you unpack it for our listener?
Of course. The common purpose rule basically means you and your passenger need to have a shared reason for the
Okay.
flight that isn't just transportation. Think of it like this. If you and your friend are both going to an air show, that's a common purpose. You're both participating in an aviation-related activity,
Right.
and the flight is part of that experience.
So it can't be like an Uber in the sky,
Exactly.
even if it's your buddy chipping in for gas.
Exactly. If the primary purpose is simply to transport someone from point A to point B, that ventures into commercial operations territory, which requires a different pilot certificate.
Okay, so that clears up the common purpose rule. Now, let's shift gears and talk about some in-flight scenarios. This one always makes my heart skip a beat. What happens if you're cruising along and suddenly notice a negative reading on your ammeter?
That's a sign your alternator has failed,
Oh boy.
which can be unnerving, especially for a new pilot. But here's the thing, the engine itself isn't directly affected.
Wait, really? I always thought that meant the engine was about to die, like a movie trope.
I know it's a common misconception.
Is it
The
really?
engine runs on magnetos,
Okay.
which are independent of the electrical system, but the alternator failure does mean you'll start losing electrical power for your avionics and other equipment
Okay.
as you rely solely on the battery.
So how long does that battery last? Is it like a race against time to find a place to land?
You've got about 20 minutes on average, but there are things you can do to stretch that time.
Oh, good.
The first thing you should do is turn off anything that isn't absolutely essential, like lights, radios, non-essential avionics. This minimizes the drain on the battery.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's not an instant emergency,
Right.
but you do need to act quickly and prioritize.
Exactly. And while you're conserving power, you can start thinking about your options for landing.
Right.
Do you have enough fuel to reach your destination or a suitable alternate? What's the terrain like below you?
Right.
It's all about staying calm and making informed decisions.
Staying calm sounds like that's key in pretty much any unexpected situation in flight.
Absolutely. You got to assess the situation, prioritize your actions, and remember your training. Panicking will only make things
Yeah,
worse.
for sure. Speaking of training, let's imagine we're approaching a busy Class C airport like Duluth, Minnesota. Could you walk us through the arrival procedures as if you were talking a student through it for the first time?
Sure. First, about 30 miles out, you tune in to the ATIS, which is the Automatic Terminal Information Service.
Right.
It's a continuous broadcast of weather, runway information, and any special procedures in effect at the airport. Having the ATIS information handy is crucial because you're required to contact approach control at 20 miles out.
So you're listening to the ATIS while you're also keeping an eye on your position,
Yeah.
altitude, making sure you're set up for that initial call to approach.
Exactly. And when you make that call, remember to keep it clear and concise. Tell them who you're calling, who you are, where you are, and what your intentions are. For example, you might say, Duluth approach, Skyhawk 12345, inbound from the southeast with the current ETIS information, requesting a full stop landing.
It's like a little introduction, letting them know everything they need about you right off the bat.
Precisely. Then they'll likely respond with instructions for your approach.
Okay.
Any traffic to be aware of, and a transponder code to squawk.
So communication is key, just like in any relationship. But what happens if things don't go exactly as planned? Let's say you're on final approach, you're lined up perfectly, but for some reason you haven't received landing clearance from the tower. What's the next step?
That's a great question, and it highlights a crucial rule. Never land without explicit clearance
Right.
from the tower. No matter how tempting it might be to just touch down,
Yeah.
you need to contact the tower again and confirm you have permission before landing.
Yeah, it's a good reminder that even when you think you're in the clear, following procedures is paramount.
Absolutely. It's all about maintaining situational awareness and communicating effectively with ATC.
So you land safely, you're feeling good, you're eager to get off the runway. Can you just exit at any point, or is there a specific procedure for that as well?
You're allowed to exit the runway after completely crossing the hold line
Okay.
without needing specific permission. However, it's good practice to announce your position
Okay.
and intentions to ground control. For instance, you could say, Skyhawk 12345, clear of runway 27, requesting taxi instructions.
So even after you land, it's still all about maintaining that clear communication loop.
Yeah.
It's a lot to keep track of, but it seems like these procedures are all in place for good reason.
They are. They might seem like extra steps, but they're designed to keep everyone safe
Right.
and the airspace organized.
That's a great point. Okay, I think we've covered a lot of ground in this first part of our deep dive. We've explored pre-flight fundamentals, arrival procedures, and even a few in-flight scenarios. It's amazing how much knowledge is packed into these seemingly simple steps.
It's all part of building that foundation
Yeah.
for safe and confident flying.
Well, we'll take a quick break here and be back soon to continue our deep dive into your checkride prep materials. Stay tuned. Welcome back to our deep dive into your checkride prep materials.
It's great to be back. We've already covered a lot of ground from pre-flight procedures to communication with ATC.
Yeah, it's amazing how each step builds on the last, creating this intricate web of knowledge that pilots need to master. Speaking of intricate webs, one concept that always makes me think of that is spatial disorientation. It can happen so quickly and without warning. What are some of the things that make pilots particularly susceptible to spatial disorientation?
One of the biggest culprits is the lack of visual references, especially when flying in clouds or at night.
Right.
Our brains rely on those visual cues to
Yeah.
help us orient ourselves in space.
Okay.
When those cues are missing, our inner ear and other senses can start sending conflicting signals, leading to disorientation.
So it's like your body is trying to tell you one thing, but your instruments are telling you something else entirely.
Exactly, and that's where the danger lies. If you're not trained to trust your instruments in those situations,
Yeah.
you can quickly find yourself in a dangerous spiral, literally.
Yeah, you're talking about a graveyard spiral, right? I
Exactly.
remember hearing about that in flight school, and it always sent chills down my spine.
Yeah, it's a classic example of how spatial disorientation can lead to a catastrophic outcome.
Right.
A pilot enters a turn, perhaps unknowingly, and fails to maintain altitude. As the aircraft descends, the pilot might feel like they're still level.
Wow.
Leading them to tighten the turn and further increase the descent rate.
It's terrifying to think about. But thankfully, we have instruments to help us avoid those situations.
Absolutely. The attitude indicator, in particular, is your best friend when it comes to spatial disorientation.
Yeah.
It tells you exactly where the horizon is, even when you can't see it with your own eyes.
Right. So the key takeaway here is trust your instruments.
Exactly.
Don't rely on your senses alone, especially when visibility is limited.
Your instruments are there to provide you with the objective information you need to make safe decisions.
Great advice. Now, let's shift gears and talk about another concept that can sometimes feel a bit abstract. Density altitude. I remember one flight early in my training where I underestimated density altitude. It was a hot day, and I was taking off from a high-altitude airport. I had calculated my takeoff distance based on pressure altitude, but I didn't fully account for the impact of the high temperatures. Let's just say it was a much closer call than I would have liked. It was a valuable lesson learned. Could you explain what density altitude is and why it's so important?
Density altitude is essentially the altitude the aircraft feels like it's at.
Okay.
Based on the combination of pressure, altitude, and temperature. As you experienced firsthand, high temperatures reduce air density,
right,
making the air thinner. This thinner air reduces lift, requires a higher takeoff speed, and increases takeoff and landing distances.
And I bet that thinner air also affects climb rate and fuel consumption, right?
You're absolutely right. The engine also produces less power in thinner air. Okay.
So your climb rate might be lower than expected, and you could burn more fuel to reach your desired altitude. So density altitude is a hidden factor that can really sneak up on you if you're not careful.
For sure.
It sounds like it's especially important to be aware of density altitude during takeoff and landing.
Yeah.
But does it have any impact on other phases of flight?
It can affect cruise performance as well.
Okay.
For example, if you're flying at a high density altitude, you might need to reduce your cruise speed to maintain optimal fuel efficiency.
Okay, that makes sense.
Okay.
So the key takeaway is to always calculate density altitude.
Yes.
Before every flight. Especially on hot days or when operating from high altitude airports.
Exactly. It only takes a few moments to calculate, and it could make all the difference in a safe and efficient flight.
Now, let's talk about a scenario that every pilot hopes to avoid but needs to be prepared for. Inadvertently entering a cloud. I remember my instructor telling me, if you find yourself in a cloud, don't panic. Just make a 180-degree turn and get back to clear air. Is that really all there is to it?
Your instructor gave you solid advice.
Okay.
The most important thing is to stay calm and remember your training. If you're not instrument rated, continuing flight into a cloud is illegal.
Right.
And extremely dangerous. The standard procedure is to make a standard rate turn 180 degrees back the way you came, trusting your instruments to maintain control of the aircraft.
So you're basically reversing course, getting out of the cloud as quickly as possible.
Exactly. And it's important to note that while making that 180-degree turn, you should maintain a constant altitude.
Right.
And airspeed.
Okay.
The tendency might be to pull back on the controls and climb.
Right.
But that could actually lead to a stall.
Oh.
Which is the last thing you want in that situation.
Yeah, it's like resisting that urge to climb out of trouble.
Exactly. Trust your instruments, maintain control, and get back to clear air as soon as possible.
Now, let's dive into some specific aircraft systems that are sure to come up on your check ride. You mentioned earlier that trusting your instruments is crucial, especially in situations like inadvertent cloud entry. Could you walk us through the different types of instruments and their functions?
Of course. Let's start with the gyroscopic instruments.
Okay.
These instruments rely on the principle of gyroscopic inertia to provide information about the aircraft's orientation and movement.
And the three main gyroscopic instruments are the attitude indicator, the heading indicator, and the turn coordinator, right?
Excellent. The attitude indicator shows the aircraft's pitch and bank attitude relative to the horizon. The heading indicator displays the aircraft's magnetic heading, and the turn coordinator indicates the rate of turn.
Right.
And the quality of the turn, whether it's coordinated or uncoordinated.
So basically, these instruments are giving you a constant picture of the aircraft's orientation in space.
Exactly. Now let's move on to the pitot-static instruments. These instruments use pressure differences to measure airspeed, altitude, and vertical speed.
And those instruments are the airspeed indicator, the vertical speed indicator, and the altimeter, if I remember correctly.
That's right. The airspeed indicator measures the difference between the dynamic pressure measured by the pitot tube and the static pressure measured by the static port to give you your airspeed. The vertical speed indicator shows the rate of climb or descent, and the altimeter indicates the aircraft's altitude above mean sea level.
It's incredible how these seemingly simple instruments use pressure differences to provide us with such crucial information.
It is, and understanding how these systems work and their potential limitations is an important part of being a safe pilot.
Now let's talk about the heart of the aircraft, the engine. You mentioned earlier that the engine runs on magnetos, which are independent of the electrical system. But beyond that basic understanding, what are some other key things pilots should know about their aircraft's engine?
You're right. Understanding how your engine works is fundamental to safe flight. You should be familiar with the type of engine, its horsepower rating, its fuel system, and its lubrication system. You should also know the proper procedures for starting, running, and shutting down the engine. And of course, you should know how to recognize and respond to any unusual engine noises or indications.
So it's not just about knowing how to fly the plane, it's about understanding the machine itself. Sounds like there's a lot to learn.
There is, but it's fascinating stuff, and it's all part of becoming a knowledgeable and proficient pilot.
Now, I remember learning the PRE acronym in flight school for spin recovery.
Oh, yeah.
Could you refresh our memory on that?
Uh-huh.
And more importantly, what are some key things to remember when it comes to actually executing a spin recovery?
PRE stands for power idle, ailerons neutral, rudder opposite the direction of the spin, elevator full forward. These are the steps for recovering from a spin. And it's important to practice them in a safe environment, like a simulator or with a qualified flight instructor. Smooth and coordinated control inputs are crucial for a successful recovery.
So it's not just about memorizing the steps, it's about being able to execute them calmly and precisely in a high-stress situation.
Exactly. And that comes with practice and experience.
Speaking of systems, could you remind us about the function of the vacuum system?
Sure.
I always think of it as one of those unsung heroes that keep things running smoothly behind the scenes.
You're right. The vacuum system often gets overlooked, but it plays a vital role in powering the attitude and heading indicators, two of our most important flight instruments.
Right.
It works by using a pump driven by the engine to create suction. This suction powers the gyroscopes inside the attitude and heading indicators, allowing them to maintain their orientation and provide accurate readings.
So it's like a miniature vacuum cleaner, keeping those crucial instruments spinning. What about carburetor heat? I know it's important for preventing carburetor ice, but could you explain how it works and when we should use it?
Carburetor heat is used to melt ice that can form in the carburetor, which restricts airflow and can cause engine problems.
Okay.
When you turn on card heat, you'll initially see a drop in engine RPM, but it will go back up after the ice is melted and the carb heat is turned off. Carb ice can form even on days when the temperature is above freezing, so it's important to be aware of the conditions that can lead to its formation and to use carburetor heat as a preventative measure.
It sounds like it's better to be safe than sorry when it comes to carb ice.
Absolutely. It's a simple procedure that can prevent a potentially serious problem.
Now, let's shift gears and talk about weight and balance.
Okay.
I know this is a crucial part of flight planning, but I've always found it to be a bit intimidating. What are some key things to remember when it comes to weight and balance calculations?
You're not alone in finding weight and balance a bit intimidating. It's a critical area, but it's not as complicated as it might seem at first. The key is to be meticulous and double-check your work. You'll need to be able to determine the aircraft's weight and center of gravity, and ensure that they fall within the limits specified in the aircraft's Pilot's Operating Handbook, POH. And remember, as we discussed earlier, your DPE suggested using higher weight estimates to increase your safety margins, which is a great practice, especially for new pilots.
So it's all about being conservative
and
ensuring you have a good margin for error.
Exactly.
What about that rule of adding 1,000 feet to takeoff and landing distances? I've heard different explanations for that. Could you clarify why we do that?
Absolutely. We add 1,000 feet to those distances because the POH numbers are optimized by manufacturers to be as competitive as possible.
Oh.
As new pilots, we need a larger margin for safety because we're still learning and might not be able to achieve those optimal performance figures just yet. And even experienced pilots need to account for factors like wind, temperature, and runway conditions,
right,
all of which can affect takeoff and landing distances.
So it's all about building in those safety margins.
Yes.
To ensure a successful takeoff and landing.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Now I think we're ready to tackle the sectional chart.
Let's do it. The sectional chart is a wealth of information, but it can be overwhelming at first glance. But once you understand the symbols and conventions, it becomes your roadmap to the sky.
Okay. I'm ready to navigate. What are some of the first things we should look for when we're planning a flight using the sectional chart?
Let's start with airspace classifications.
Okay.
You've shared some great information about the different types of airspace and their associated requirements. You've got Class A, B, C, D, E, and G airspace, each with its own unique characteristics and rules.
Right, and I remember that Class A airspace is generally for high-altitude flights above 18,000 feet, requires an instrument flight plan and a transponder with altitude reporting capability. Class B airspace surrounds major airports and requires an explicit clearance from ATC to enter. Class C airspace surrounds smaller airports and requires two-way radio communication with ATC. Class D airspace is typically found around airports with a control tower and also requires two-way radio communication. Class E airspace extends from the surface to 18,000 feet and generally doesn't have specific entry or communication requirements, although there are exceptions. And finally, Class G airspace is uncontrolled airspace and doesn't have any specific equipment or communication requirements. It's a lot to remember.
It is, but it's all about understanding the different levels of complexity and control within the airspace system.
Now, what about the Mode C veil? I know we touched on that earlier, but could you remind us what it is and what equipment is required to fly within it?
The Mode C veil surrounds many busy airports and requires aircraft to have an operating Mode C transponder and ADS-B out equipment. This equipment allows ATC to track the aircraft's altitude and position more accurately, enhancing safety in congested airspace.
So it's all about improving situational awareness and preventing mid-air collisions.
Exactly. And speaking of avoiding congested airspace, you mentioned earlier the example of flying into Lake Elmo Airport 21D, which is near Class B airspace.
Right.
How would you go about planning a flight to Lake Elmo if you don't have clearance to enter the Bravo?
Well, if you're not equipped or authorized to enter Class B airspace, you can fly below the Bravo airspace to reach your destination. Requires careful planning and awareness of the airspace boundaries.
Right.
But it's a viable option.
That's a great point. And it highlights the importance of understanding the airspace and being able to adapt your flight plan accordingly.
Now let's say you buy a Piper Cub for a business and want to base it out of Lake Elmo 21D. You want to keep costs down, so what's the minimum avionics you need to be legal without entering Class B airspace?
In that scenario, you'd still need a Mode C transponder and ADS-B out equipment to comply with the Mode C veil requirements, but you wouldn't need a two-way radio as long as you stay below the Class Bravo airspace.
So you can still operate legally and safely without breaking the bank on avionics.
Exactly. And that's a good reminder that you don't need the most sophisticated equipment to enjoy the freedom of flight.
Now let's talk about MEF, or maximum elevation figures. On the sectional chart, what exactly do those numbers represent and why are they important for flight planning?
MEF indicates the highest obstruction in each quadrant of the sectional chart.
Okay.
It's crucial information for terrain awareness, especially when flying in mountainous areas or at lower altitudes. When you're flying in those environments, you need to be aware of the highest obstacles in your vicinity to avoid potential collisions with terrain.
So MEF is like a safety net.
Yeah.
Alerting you to potential hazards in your flight path.
Exactly. And it's always a good idea to err on the side of caution when it comes to terrain clearance.
Now let's review visibility and cloud requirements for different airspace classifications. I know that visibility and cloud clearances vary depending on the airspace you're flying in, but could you give us a quick overview of some of the key requirements?
Sure. For example, in Class G airspace below 1,200 feet AGL during the day, you need one statute mile of visibility and to remain clear of clouds. At night, the visibility requirement increases to 3 statute miles. In Class E airspace below 10,000 feet MSL, you generally need 3 statute miles of visibility, and to stay 500 feet below clouds, 1,000 feet above clouds, and 2,000 feet horizontally from clouds.
And how can you legally fly in Class Echo on a day with less than the minimum visibility?
You can obtain a special VFR clearance from ATC. This clearance allows you to fly in Class Echo with lower visibility than normally required.
Okay.
But you need to meet specific altitude and cloud clearance requirements.
So it's a way to operate in less than ideal conditions while still maintaining a safe level of separation from obstacles and other aircraft.
Exactly. Now, let's wrap up our discussion of the sectional chart by talking about MOAs and restricted zones. These are both areas on the sectional chart that pilots need to be aware of.
Right. And I remember that MOAs, or military operating areas, are areas where military aircraft conduct training exercises. While civilian aircraft are generally allowed to fly through MOAs, it's important to exercise caution and be aware of the potential for high-speed aircraft operations. It's like sharing the airspace with fighter jets and other military aircraft. Definitely something to be aware of.
You got it. Restricted zones, on the other hand, are areas where flying is prohibited unless you have specific authorization. They are often used for sensitive government or military installations, or for other special purposes.
So it's best to just avoid restricted zones altogether, unless you have a specific reason and authorization to be there.
Exactly. And remember, it's always a good idea to check the NOTAMs, or notices to airmen,
right,
before every flight to get the latest information about airspace restrictions, hazards, and other important details that could affect your flight planning.
It sounds like staying informed is key to safe and legal flight operations. Wow, we've covered a lot of ground in this second part of our deep dive. From spatial disorientation to sectional charts, we've explored a wide range of topics that are essential for passing your check ride and becoming a safe and confident pilot.
It's been great diving into these topics with you. It's amazing how much there is to learn about aviation, but it's also fascinating and rewarding.
Well, we're going to take a quick break here and be back soon to wrap up our deep dive into your check ride prep materials. Stay tuned. Welcome back to our final deep dive into your check ride prep materials. I feel like we've covered so much.
Yeah, we have. From pre-flight procedures to navigating complex airspace, it's really been great. And all the essential knowledge and skills needed to become a safe and confident pilot.
It really makes you think about how all of these connect.
Yeah.
To the bigger picture.
Absolutely.
Of, you know, aviation safety and professionalism.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. It's not just about memorizing facts and procedures. It's about understanding the why behind them and developing good judgment as a pilot.
Good judgment. Speaking of good judgment, you mentioned earlier the common purpose rule for carrying passengers.
Mm.
Could you maybe walk us through a few more, like, real world examples to illustrate the difference between a legitimate common purpose and just simply providing transportation for hire?
Absolutely. Let's say you and a friend are both members of a flying club and you want to fly to a nearby airport for a club meeting.
Okay.
That would be considered a common purpose because you're both participating in an aviation-related activity.
So it's not just about sharing expenses. It's about having a genuine purpose related to aviation.
Exactly. Another example might be flying with a friend to take aerial photos of a real estate development. You're both involved in the photography project, and the flight is incidental to that purpose. But if you're just flying your neighbor to a doctor's appointment in another city, that would be considered transportation for hire, even if they offer to contribute to the fuel costs.
Right. It's subtle but important. It highlights the need for pilots to be aware of the regulations and operate within the bounds of their, you know, their pilot certificate.
Just sure.
Okay. Now, shifting gears to aircraft systems, I'd like to kind of revisit the vacuum system a little bit. We talked about how it powers those attitude and heading indicators. What are some signs of a potential vacuum system failure that pilots should be aware of?
That's a great question. If the vacuum system fails, you'll likely see the attitude and heading indicators start to drift or become erratic.
Right. I remember learning that.
You might also hear unusual noises from the vacuum pump. Or you might notice a drop in vacuum pressure on the gauge. If you suspect a vacuum system failure, it's crucial to cross-check your instruments and rely on other sources of information, like the turn coordinator and the magnetic compass.
Right, so it's all about just being vigilant and recognizing any signs of trouble early on. And speaking of trouble, I'd like to revisit the scenario of an alternator failure. We talked about conserving battery power, but what other steps should a pilot take if they experience an alternator failure in flight?
If you find yourself dealing with an alternator failure, the first thing is to stay calm. Remember, as we discussed earlier, the engine will continue to run because it's powered by the magnetos, not the electrical system. Next, turn off all non-essential electrical equipment to conserve battery power.
Right.
This might include lights, radios, and non-essential avionics.
And while you're doing that, you should also be thinking about your options for landing.
Exactly. Consider your fuel reserves, the terrain below you, the weather conditions, and the proximity of suitable landing sites. If you're close to your destination or a suitable alternate airport, it might be best to continue there. But if you're over unfavorable terrain or the weather's deteriorating, you might need to consider landing at the nearest suitable airport, even if it's not your intended destination.
Right. All about making those critical decisions based on, you know, the available information and prioritizing safety above all else.
Absolutely. And remember, if you're ever in doubt, you can always contact air traffic control for assistance. They're there to help you.
They are, yeah. Finally, I wanted to touch on one more topic that I think is often a source of confusion for new pilots, and that's density altitude.
Okay.
We talked about how it affects takeoff and landing performance, but how can pilots, like, accurately calculate density altitude? and factor that into their flight planning?
There are a few ways to calculate density altitude.
Okay.
You can use a flight computer, an electronic flight bag, EFB app, or even a simple density altitude chart. The key is to have accurate information about the pressure, altitude, and temperature at your departure airport.
And once you've calculated the density altitude, how do you use that information to make informed decisions about takeoff and landing performance?
You'll need to consult your aircraft's performance charts, which are found in the POH.
Okay.
These charts provide data on takeoff and landing distances, climb rates, and other performance parameters based on factors like weight, temperature, and density altitude.
It's like a puzzle putting all the pieces together to kind of get a clear picture of how the aircraft will perform in those specific conditions.
That's a great way to put it. It's all about being informed and prepared.
Well, I think we've reached the end of our check ride, prep deep dive. It's been an incredible journey exploring all these essential concepts and skills.
It has, and I hope our listener feels more confident and prepared for their check ride and for their future as a pilot.
For sure. I know I've learned a lot from this conversation. It's a reminder that aviation is a constantly evolving field, and there's always something new to learn and discover.
That's what makes it so fascinating, and that pursuit of knowledge and excellence, that's what makes truly great pilots. To our listener, best of luck on your check ride. Remember, confidence comes from knowledge and practice.
Yeah.
Fly safe and enjoy the journey.
Blue skies and tailwinds. Yeah.